pass, James. Thanks, Mike. Hi, everybody. My name is Merle. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 15th, 2003. Like Mike said, I got a home group in Buckingham, and I got a sponsor. All those things I found important to stay sober. I'll tell you a little bit of what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. I got a lot of what happened. you know, I'll tell you that I grew up out in the Midwest and started drinking when I was like 14. And I didn't think I was going to be a heavy drinker because I got brothers that were in a lot of trouble. When I was growing up, they were going to the boys' reform schools and started going to jail by the time I was getting older and getting kicked out of colleges. And, you know, they were in trouble all the time. And I saw that it caused my parents a lot of problems. And I didn't want to cause my parents any problems. I didn't really like my mother much, but I liked my dad. I worked for him a lot at his gas station. And I guess I got to hear a lot of, you know, don't you do that when you get older, you know, kind of thing. And I never was going to do any of that stuff. But by the time I was 15 or so, some of my good buddies were drinking beer regularly on the weekends. And it sounded a little appealing. As long as I wasn't doing any drugs, I'd be all right. And because that's where my brothers went wrong. And I started drinking beer with these guys, and the first night we was drinking, we were staying all night in this machine shed, and so there was no parents around for the whole evening, and they busted out this case of cold beer and it passed through the ribbon, and I had one, and I said, I don't think I'm ever going to be a beer drinker, you know, I can't take this. Well, they had some beer left over from last weekend underneath the barn. They went and got a six-pack of Budweiser. A star was born. You know, I love that stuff. I used to say there's three kings in this world, Budweiser, Bob Seger, and Richard Petty. You know, and I drank Budweiser all the time. I used to have the label memorized that had this paragraph on it, you know. I guess when you're 15, you ain't got nothing better to do than memorize what's on the beer labels, but I didn't anyway. But I was pretty much the heaviest drinker everybody hung out with, you know. And I found a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous say the same thing, you know. So I'm pretty sure I started out, you know, a drunk, you know. I always got drunk when I drank. I mean, that first night, after those seven beers, I remember, you know, I don't remember feeling awkward or any of that kind of stuff growing up. I've worked at my dad's gas station and other people's gas stations and knew everybody in town and got along with everybody. And, you know, I didn't feel as, I don't know, shy and all that kind of stuff. I just don't think I was, except for around girls. I was real shy around girls. Like, I don't think I ever went on a date when I was in high school. But by the time high school started, I was already drinking every weekend with the guys. And started drinking on FFA bowling night. And, you know, two or three weeknights a week. And by the time I graduated, I drank every day, every night. We rarely drank during the day. I had to go to work in the afternoon. But, you know, if there was some cold beer at lunchtime and we were skipping school, you know, I could have a couple, you know. And then I could stop abruptly and wait till evening before I started drinking again. So maybe I wasn't an alcoholic at that time, you know. But maybe I could have stopped, but I didn't want to. I really enjoyed drinking, you know. I got along with everybody when I was sober, but I got along with them even a whole lot better when I was drunk. And I was the life of most parties. Everybody, you know, was like, all right, Merle's here, you know. I was the guy that walked around with a pitcher of beer and wouldn't give anybody, you know, oh, hey, you're serving beer tonight. Like, hell no, this is my pitcher, you know. And it was a keg, you know. He'd have all he wanted. I wouldn't give anybody my beer, you know. There'd be contests who could hold their head on the keg the longest. I always won, you know. The other guys would have to go puke. I'd just have another beer, you know. That was all working good for me until, and getting stopped by the cops a lot. And that worked out fine too, you know. They always just sent me home. They woke me up at stop signs and sent me home. I'd be passed out with the truck and drive at a stop sign, and they'd wake me up and send me home, you know. I've run from the cops on my motorcycle drunk and laid it down in some bushes so they wouldn't see me, and they circled the block until they found me and sent me home, you know. I got along with the cops good, and I don't know if getting arrested a bunch of times when I was a teenager would have helped me stop earlier. I don't know, you know. But I know that they didn't help me by letting me go home. I don't know. I don't see intervention helping a lot of people until they're ready to stop drinking. But I don't know. I think I was like 22 years old, and I'd had a couple DUIs. The first time DUI they gave me, or I earned, or whatever you call that. I drove my 63 Lincoln Continental through town like 110 miles an hour. It's the day before graduation. You know, it's a little strip, kind of like Madison, you know. And I'd buzz through there 110 miles an hour just to show them how fast we could go. And it was a little bit bigger than Madison. There was a couple bars getting out. It was 2 o'clock. They shut the bars down. And all these people are downtown and standing out on the street deliriously drunk. And they could hear something coming. I didn't have any mufflers on this car. They could hear us coming, you know. Big old tanker coming down the road and 110 miles an hour. It would bottom out at every intersection. The springs were bad, I guess. And I'd look in my mirrors to see if any of the cops were behind us yet, because we ran past a whole bunch of them. And it was like a bee's nest, this gas station I used to work at. They'd be in there drinking coffee at night. And all it was, when I drove by, there was like a flash. And all I saw was this guy like this. I took it that he was running to his car. And then we were at another intersection. Boom! You know. And I look in my mirror, and we'd be hitting another one. And I'd look in my mirror, and I could see sparks at the last corner. You know. Everybody in the car is, you know, my buddy's got his hand on the dash. He's just looking to see how many cops are behind us. But there's a girl sitting in the back seat. Her boyfriend's passed out. She's standing up, beating on my back. Stop the car, Merle. Stop the car. I like, it's too late for that, you know. But she finally talked me into it by the time we got to the other side of town. So I put it in neutral and tried to put it in my buddy's farm that was on the edge of town where we did our first drinking in that machine shed. And all I saw was grass flying up in the air when I pulled into his place. I guess we were going too fast. And I put it back on the road and made it past the cemetery, which was across the street. And when the cops came over that hill and saw all the grass in there, they just knew that there was a bunch of dead kids around. And when he finally got to where I was at, it was one of the guys that stopped me a million times, you know. And he was shaking mad. And I got my electric went up. What are you stopping me for tonight, Denny? He's like, driver, get out of the car. He was just totally upset with me. And I imagine kind of relieved that there wasn't a bunch of dead kids around, because two of the girls were going to graduate the next day. It was the day before graduation. And I guess that goes on in small towns, you know. Kids die in car wrecks, you know, and they thought they had one on their hands. Because everybody knew me. Everybody knew who rode around with me. And they just knew there were some teenage kids going to be dead that night. And thank God that didn't happen. I got to go to jail for the first time. And I asked them to lock me up, but they called my parents. You know, I'd already graduated. They made my dad come and get me, and he let me drive the car home. You know, there was no repercussions at home either. Just, you know, you're going to turn out like your brothers being careful. Mama's still proud of me. I hadn't gotten as much trouble with my brothers, you know. She didn't set any high standards at our place. You know, D's were passed, and that's all she cared about, and that's all I ever got. I went on a couple years more drinking, and every night at the bars, everybody knew me. And still having a good time with it, you know. Drinking was a lot of fun when I first started out. And I can't say what it was that started making it bad, but I think it was that I wanted to stop drinking a little bit, you know. I didn't want to be the deliriously drunk guy that I was getting to be. You know, I was starting to get fired from jobs. I was sick a lot, and I just wasn't happy unless I was drinking. And then sometimes I wasn't happy when I was drinking either. And I'd been to several probation guys, you know, and alcohol addiction counselors or whatever they called them. And I think he's the one that pretty much let me know that I was an alcoholic. He was in AA. One of the last times I went home, I went to an AA meeting, and he picked up his 50-year medallion. And he told me when I was going to see him that he wasn't going to turn me into the probation officer or anything. Whatever we said between us was confidential. And he said, I'm worried you're going to be like me. You know, he'd tell me stories about him landing trees and cars, or cars and trees and different shit. And, you know, he'd walk with a peg leg. You know, had to get it cut off in some accident, and he said, I'm afraid you're going to turn out like me, you know, and he told me about his drinking, and I think that, you know, he's the one that let me know about alcoholism, and that I probably did have it, and I think I was around 20 or 22, somewhere in there. All I remember about that was when I left, I was done seeing him, you know, or 90 days were up or whatever. I told him that I might be an alcoholic, but I'm too young to quit. I'll quit when I'm 26 or so. Well, I can't tell you what happened in the next couple years because I don't remember very well. But by the time I was 24, I was ready to join the Army to quit drinking. Because every time I quit drinking on my own, I feel like I need to go to the insane asylum, you know. I'm just depressed. And I finally found a recruiter that would fraudulently enlist me. He said, I've signed this paper that I've looked at your Iowa records and you don't have any tickets. Because at that time, if you had a few DUIs and public intoxications and criminal mischiefs and a few other things that I had, you couldn't join the military. And in fact, we talked to a judge one time, see if I could join the military to get out of a DUI, and he's like, they might have done that in the 60s, Kelly, but they don't do that anymore. But then he let me off with no fine, you know. I got convicted, but no fine. Fine suspended. Whew, thanks, you know. That was funny, too. The lawyer asked me before we went to see this judge, he says, hey, Kelly, that judge we're going to have is a local judge. Do you know him? I said, yeah. Well, we can get a change of venue then. Heck no, man. I want to go see this guy, you know. And it worked out as far as money went anyway. I didn't have to pay a fine on that one. I got several of them. But anyway, I did get into the military, and I didn't drink for 8 weeks, you know. Total control. We were never out of some drill sergeant's sight, and I did fine. You know, they kept me busy all the time. But as soon as basic training was over, I forgot why I joined the Army, and I was taking those young guys out to get drunk for their first times, some of them their first times anyway. And my drinking was just like usual. I got deliriously drunk the first time I went out and still had to go back to the barracks, you know. And I was kind of worried about it when I left, but when I got drunk, I wasn't worried about it, you know. And I suffered some consequences from that. you know, some humiliation, you know, I'm in a barracks with 60 guys and there's a pile of piss underneath my bunk. Got to do extra PT for coming in late. You know, we do enough PT already, physical training, but now we got to go down at 9 o'clock at night and hold rubber M16s above our head while we jog in place for half an hour and then do some other stuff with that stuff. And those fake M16s had better not hit the ground. And they weighed like four times more than a regular. You know, it was exhausting. Me and three or four other guys, we was lucky we made it. But anyway, I went to my regular duty station, and one of the first things that happened to me there is I got a DUI. I was tripping on acid. And I told the counselors there that, you know, it was a freak thing that happened, you know. I was at a guy's anniversary party, and I had too many drinks. And I mean, here there's counselors here to help me get sober in the Army, and I'm lying to them. I've forgotten I joined the Army to quit drinking, and here's a golden opportunity to stop right now. I'm lying to them. They believe me. You know, they look at my Iowa records, and I don't have any. You know, I got a sergeant that signed me up. Says he's never been in trouble in his life. And that's all the farther they go. They don't have to waste time going back to Iowa to check it out. They get some recruiter to check that out. Anyway, I went to that, I don't know what you call it. It wasn't rehab, but it was like some 2 hours of group therapy for, that time was 30 days. The next time was longer. You know, I got in trouble again. I don't remember. I think we were smoking pot. We had a keg of beer, too, at a public beach in Alabama, and they don't drink beer on Sunday in Alabama. We didn't know that. You know, we got a keg of beer, and, you know, we're all smoking reefer, and one of the off-duty cops is out there fishing. He called his buddies, and it was like SWAT team showed up. They had guns pulled and everything, man, throwing my friends up on the hoods of their cars, and they got paraphernalia off every one of us. We were in the military, so we didn't carry a lot of reefer with us, but we all got tickets for that and having an open container. yeah, a big one. And there's only like six of us. We had a keg of beer, you know. So that got me back into rehab a couple more times, and I never went to a regular rehab, like, you know, 28-day dry-out center or anything like that. I always went to these, down to the counseling center for 2 hours, you know. I was lucky they let me off work for 2 hours to go down there. And, I tried to lie to him the second time I went there, and they told me I was full of crap, and he happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just came clean and told him, I'd drink at least 12-pack a day unless I drink more, you know. He says, do you think you're an alcoholic? I said, well, probably, you know. Are you ready to stop drinking? Yeah. You know, that day I think I was, you know. And I went to AA meetings. Only reason I got a sponsor was because that seemed to be one of the things that the counselor wanted to hear about. And I got a sponsor that was a counselor at the rehab. And I was out partying with some friends one night, and I wasn't drinking, but all my friends were. And that sponsor dude was at one of the bars we was at. He said it wasn't a mixed drink, but it sure looked like it to me. I was like, man, this is my second time to be in AA that I've seen people not doing what they say they do. You know, the first one was back in my hometown where the lady that was chairing the meeting had sold me some hash earlier that day. You know? I said, boy, this AA is a crock of shit. But I think this last time I was in AA that I was just talking about, you know, I heard people that I thought were, they convinced me that they were just like me not long ago, and that they don't drink anymore, and they don't sell hash on the weekends, or, you know, and they seem to be happy, You know, and they said they were the same sad sack I was when they weren't drinking before they came to AA. And that it helped them. And I heard them talking about God. You know, they had those window shades at this clubhouse we went to. And if I didn't hear it, I sure saw it, you know, those steps on the wall. I was like, oh, my God, you know. I've been saying, oh, my God, all my life, but I don't believe in God, you know. And so I left again, you know. The heat was off, and I left AA because I wasn't gonna surrender to any higher power. What a load that was to me at the time. And I don't remember. Well, I do remember the last thing that happened to me in the military was I got another DUI, and there was a lot of times in between there though before that last DUI that I was miserable and trying to stay sober on my own. And I just couldn't do it. After so many weeks or days, I just had to go have a couple beers to loosen up. And I'm one of those guys that's never had a couple beers, you know. When I go to have a couple beers, I end up staying until the place closes down. I usually drank in bars. I don't know how I got so many DUIs. I guess I rode around and drank a lot too, but I was a barroom drinker most of the time. Unless I was out of money. But that happened a lot. It was weird, man. The Army paid you for a month's salary and gave me a free place to stay, and I'd be out of money before the month was over. Every month. You know, I never had any money. And that last DUI, of course, landed me back into some Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and a counselor and my out-processing papers. They kicked me out of the Army for that last DUI, and I knew, you know, the gig was up, you know. I had to stop drinking, you know. I thought I'd been miserable long enough, you know. Drinking really had quit being fun quite a few years prior to that, and I just kept chasing the fun that I used to get out of it, and it wasn't there anymore. Because I was a blackout drinker, you know, I hardly ever remember being at bars a lot of times. So I don't know how much fun I could have been having, you know. It's funny, you know, for the first 5 years, drinking was a blast, and after that, it was just drinking. And I didn't have troubles to get rid of. I was in trouble a lot, but, you know, that's just the way I operated. I just had to drink and smoke dope or whatever, you know. And I decided that I was just going to have to do what they say they do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to have to start believing in God. And I didn't, even though I didn't want to and didn't believe there was such a thing. And I didn't go to any meetings that had a lot of structure or anything like that. You know, we could dress however we wanted to dress, and I rode my motorcycle in there with my Harley Davidson t-shirts on, and everybody liked me, you know, and welcomed me, and I got a sponsor, and that was a self-centered thing, too. I got a sponsor that said that he had his own place and that he didn't have to pay rent because he got rifted out of the Army, whatever that means. And that the Army paid his rent while he went to college. And I was like, that guy can be my sponsor and give me a place to stay. Till I find a job. And it worked real good, you know, because his plan was, well, you don't have to pay me any rent. And you don't have to find a job. He said, you just need to go to the noon meeting every day, and I'll take you to the evening meetings every night. You know, if you don't make the noon meetings, you can't stay at my place. I was like, all right. So I went to a lot more meetings than most people did in the beginning. You know, I went to two or three a day for a long time until I got a girlfriend. And then I moved out. And then I had to get a job. And then I had to move back to my sponsor's house. And then I got a girlfriend. And I had to get another job. My first few years in AA, staying off the sauce and drugs was chaotic, you know. my sponsor took me through the steps. We read the 12 and 12 together, and that was us doing the steps. And I don't know that I was any better. I wasn't as the sad sack that I was when I was quitting on my own. I think that I was probably feeling better because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings all the time and talked to people, and people got to listen to all my problems a lot. You know, when I'm standing on the porch of the meeting today and I'm listening to this guy go on and on about some crap, you know, I'm like, people stood and listened to your crap for years, you know, so another 45 minutes ain't going to hurt you, you know. Because I don't want to stand and listen to somebody's crap. But, and that's, you know, I didn't know that I was a self-centered individual. You know, I knew that it said that in AA somewhere, but I didn't read the big book. I knew that was in there somewhere because I guess I'd heard it at meetings, you know. And I was like, yeah, I probably am. I've related to everything else these guys are, you know. But I don't recognize it. Took a long time, too, even after I did start reading the big book, for me to recognize that I'm selfish and self-centered. But I moved around a bunch and had a sponsor from time to time, didn't have a sponsor from time to time. By the time I moved to Nelson County, I didn't have a sponsor. None of them lived up to my standards. You know, I'd been in AA for 10 years. At that time it was only 7 years. You know, these guys ain't doing it right. And I stayed unsponsored for quite a while. And before long, I started smoking pot and going to AA meetings. And that didn't work very good for me. You know, I had a guilty conscience all the time. I was unhappy at home all the time. The only time I was at any kind of peace was when I was high and I couldn't smoke dope at home. My wife's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she wouldn't have put up with it, you know. And I worked for the county, and they wouldn't have put up with it, so they didn't know I was high at work. I did get high there a lot. I mean, we don't have a lot of upscale folks showing up at the dump, so, you know, most of the folks are loaded when they come in there. I still work there today. I know they're loaded. Some of them tell me they are. You know, it wasn't working very good, and I couldn't stop that on my own either. I really thought I was going to have to go to rehab, because I wouldn't tell anybody in AA I was smoking dope. And finally, you know, I just stopped, and I guess we'd call it white knuckling it, you know. I didn't tell anybody, and I finally started going to some meetings that had structure, you know, coming in on time, not getting up and going to get a cup of coffee. But the thing that attracted me was that I knew these people knew about the big book, and by this time, after 10 years of being in Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew the real solution to alcoholism was in the big book. And I went over there to see what I could glean from that, you know. I really still, at that time, thought it was something I could learn. You know, if I could just figure out how this stuff works, I'll be fine. And I've been trying to figure it out for a long time, and I hadn't had any success yet. But all I heard over there was that at this Buckingham meeting was that, you know, it's nothing to figure out here. There's just stuff to do. And 2 meetings a week wasn't cutting it, you know. And this guy asked me after the meeting, I told him, you know, when it came time to share, I said that I came over there to see if I could learn what was in the big book and start doing something different in my life, you know, because I knew AA worked. I didn't know how it worked. And this guy asked me after the meeting if I wanted him to take me through the book. And I was like, yeah, sure. Excellent. Well, he took me through the book, but he had a few requirements of me, and I go to at least 5 meetings a week, and that I got a job in some of those meetings, And I started doing it. You know, I don't think this guy's ever made any kind of request to me that I said, nope, I ain't doing that. You know, I do want to stay sober more than I want to get drunk or loaded or anything else. And I want the peace of mind that people in Alcoholics Anonymous seem to have. And I've been, as soon as I heard him tell somebody else they only needed to go to four meetings, I stopped right then. I'm still not very good at being sponsored. He asked me one day on one of our weekly telephone calls, you know, hey, you ain't been at that Thursday night meeting for 2 or 3 weeks. What's going on there? Well, I heard you say the other day you only need to go to 4 meetings a week, so I said I'd cut that one out. He said, well, that's fine. He said, well, we need some communication here. You know, I'm not much of a communicator either. I don't tell anybody what's going on between my ears. And I found out that I've got to start doing better at that, because I still believe a lot of the stuff I think. And that's what's got me in all the trouble I've ever been in, is my thinking, you know. And surrendering my judgment to somebody else, you know. I thought that was crazy until I started doing it. And, you know, my life has gotten nothing but better since then. You know, I've gotten more active in AA. I go to 4 or 5 conferences every year. Go to 4 or 5 meetings every week. I think this is my 6th meeting this week. Just that's the way it turned out. And, I talk to my sponsor once a week, and he's had a couple of those meetings. I rarely talk to him at the meetings, though, because he seems to be pretty busy with a bunch of other folks. But, you know, he's not one of those guys I'd hang out with, but I'd take his direction, you know. And, you know, I've said before that I kind of, like, balked at stuff he said, but in reflection for me, I've never balked at anything he said. You know, I believe everything he tells me. And I think that's one of the reasons I've been staying sober. You know, I take someone else's directions. Because, like I said a minute ago, my thinking screwed me up so many times. And I don't know what else I was going to talk about. Today I've been working on my house, and I've been doing some remodeling, got a guy helping me, and when I was drinking, I never owned a house before, you know, until I got sober. I never been in a relationship that lasted more than 3 months when I was drinking, or early sobriety. I've been married for like 11 years now. The house will be paid for next year. And when I was smoking dope and going to meetings and sponsoring myself, my wife would tell me all these things are broken around the house. I get that taken care of one of these days. Because I'm a real tightwad. And I'm not hiring a contractor to come out and fix something in this dump. And I'll fix it myself. Well, it never got fixed for years. And we're just about to finish up replacing the floor joists and the band boards, the whole underside of the house, you know. And if I wasn't at, and go to 4 or 5 meetings a week, you know, I can find time to do stuff today. I mean, I'm one of those guys that used to sit on the couch and not do nothing. And it's funny, Tom and I was talking about this one day, you know. It says in the big book somewhere around the 3rd step about a guy sitting in the Florida sunshine complaining about the state of the nation. And that's me. I'm laying on the couch complaining about the state of my house when I could be up fixing it, you know. I don't know anything about carpentry, but we got new floor joists. And it's been a major job, you know. But we haven't quit. And thought about it a time or two, you know, but I'd never had that ambition to do that if I was drinking or sponsoring myself, because I didn't before, you know. I didn't do anything around my house. And like I said, you know, my wife comes up with something that needs to be done, and generally I just go do it, you know, instead of think, you know. There's been a lot of that lately of my thinking, don't I do enough? You know, don't I do enough? Nah, I don't think so. You know, and I haven't told my sponsor about that yet. Because, you know, he's active. You know, he goes to lots of meetings, does lots of conferences, and he does lots of stuff at his house, you know. And why don't I, you know? And, you know, I am happier. I know that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, me being happy. But I am happy when I'm busy, even though I want to be, you know, laying on the couch. I got shit to do, and I'm laying on the couch, and then I'm depressed by the end of the day. I didn't do anything today, you know. But I still, with my own thinking, think I deserve a break, you know. And I need anything but that, you know. And I only got that from having a sponsor that points that out to me. And one day he told me, I guess I was looking sad, I don't know. I didn't say anything about it. And he said, you know, if you get a haircut, you'd feel better. I was like, God, this guy even wants me to get a haircut, you know. So I went and got a haircut, and I think I must have started feeling better. You know, I'm just crazy. You know, and I need the direction of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm serious. My life has gotten a lot better. You know, I got friends here. You know, and I do have a purpose in life today. You know, I never had a purpose before. You know. I'm not one of those guys that set goals and objectives for my life, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous is good for me. And so why don't I just be active in AA? And that's what I do, and everything seems to be a lot better. And I don't have much else to say. Y'all get out a little early tonight. Thanks.